Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Hello everyone and welcome to a Bring Back V10's gift for you while we are between series. If you're missing us, then you might like what we're up to in the Race Members Club at the moment. As you're about to hear, we've now kicked off our race-by-race look back over the 1997 F1 season, voted by our audience as the best year of the V10 era. We're going to be releasing short episodes about each race exclusively to our members, but for those of you who haven't signed up yet, we're giving you episode 1 on the season-opening Australian Grand Prix so you can get a feel for it. Episode 2 on the Brazilian Grand Prix is already out for our members, so if you like what you hear and want to crack straight into the next instalment, then head to the link in the description to sign up to the Members Club. Or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up directly in that app if you only want the race's bonus audio content and none of the other benefits that we offer. So here's Australia 97, and we look forward to having as many of you as possible joining us for the rest of the season.
Go, go, go!
Welcome to the start of something brand new that's going to be a lot of fun here in the Race Members Club. I mean, I say brand new, we're going back in time more than a quarter of a century, so it can't be that new. But it's a new approach for what's effectively a Bring Back V10 spin-off. Over the coming weeks, we're going to be revisiting the 1997 F1 season, voted as the best season of the V10 era by our audience, one race at a time in a series of mini-episodes that will be made available exclusively to our members. We are giving away a taster of this opening episode in our main feed, so you can get a feel for it if you're not already signed up. And if you like what you hear and you'd like to get stuck into this with us, race by race, as well as enjoying all the other benefits on offer from the race, then come and join us in the Members Club. You'll find a link in the description of this episode to sign up directly via our website, which gets you the full range of benefits. Or if you'd just like access to our bonus audio content and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up in that app too. Our plan is to cover roughly half of the 97 season between now and when Series 10 starts in July, and then we'll pick back up and finish the season between Series 10 and 11 in the final part of the year. Joining me, Glenn Freeman, for what should be a fun ride are three people who you can all trust to make sure this doesn't turn into a wild celebration of all things Jacques Villeneuve. We've got Ben Anderson, Matt Beer and Ed Straw here, and schedules permitting, you'll have all four of us every single time. We're also bringing in a new opening question for this format, so let's debut that now. Gents, I want each of you to describe the race we're about to talk about. So in this case, the 1997 Australian Grand Prix, in 5 words or less. Ben, you can go first.
Damon, what have you done?
Excellent. Matt, your turn.
Johnny Herbert was robbed.
Yeah, I like that. And Ed.
Idiot, screwed it up again.
Yeah, Ed Irvine. Right. These won't be like the usual full-on Bring Back V10 episodes. I've not done weeks of research to dig up all the news from the time, for example. We're just going to dive into our memories from the on-track action. And I don't know about you guys, but I've refreshed my memory by rewatching the season review and the F1 TV highlights of these races. So it's not all based on 25-year-old or more, 25-plus-year-old memories. Cracking straight on, though, the standout thing, and this doesn't set the tone for the series, I promise, but the first place we're going in the weekend is qualifying with what I think we have to say is Jacques Villeneuve's most memorable qualifying lap ever. In fact, it might be, other than his debut pole position a year earlier, it's probably his only memorable qualifying lap. A 1:29.3 that was 1.7 seconds faster than teammate Heinz-Harald Frentzen in second.
Was it wet?
Well, Villeneuve's on pole, so probably not. 2.1 seconds faster than Michael Schumacher's Ferrari in third. Ed, I know that in the early days of the V10 era, we might see these sort of gaps with dominant cars, but this is ludicrous, this sort of gap between the top three cars.
Yeah, it was enormous dominance, but it wasn't even just one magic lap. His conservative banker lap right at the start of qualifying was enough for pole by 6/10. And that second run was the pole time. And then when the track was slower later on, he basically replicated the lap. He was a tenth slower. So it wasn't just a single qualifying lap. It was a crushing qualifying performance all the way through, and very exuberant at the wheel as well, Villeneuve. He was mega confident in that car. So really at his best.
It was great to watch, wasn't it? It was a proper magical Villeneuve hooked up with the car. Melbourne sort of peculiarities. Soft tyre war tyres for the first time for Villeneuve to play with as well. The crazy thing is, as beautiful as that was to watch, you look at that and you think, this is, I'm going to say it, Nigel Mansell 92 level dominance in the kind of that sort of gap between teammates and Williams that far ahead of the field. And he doesn't exactly Mansell the season from there, really, does he?
There you go, listeners. I promised you that they wouldn't let me off the hook. No, I remember watching this live. And I remember, I think, Martin Brundle's commentary. Brundle's calling the lap. This was his first weekend in the commentary box full-time for ITV, wasn't it? And Brundle got really good, didn't he, at talking you round a mega lap, often after the fact, but he was very good at doing it live as well. And I seem to remember Villeneuve comes out the last corner, I think, and kicks up the dirt, and Brundle's going, oh, he's dropped a wheel off the curb, that won't hurt him, or something like that. Because I remember panicking. I was thinking, he's going off. But Brundle, you know, was adamant that no, he's got it nailed and kicks up the dirt. So it's proper on the limit stuff. And yeah, at that point, as you say, Matt, when I saw that gap, I just thought he's got the best car by a mile. Williams have done it again after 96. He's going to walk this season.
And just to add insult to injury for Heinz-Harald Frentzen, it was only that last minute post red flag lap that got him to second. He was seventh before that moment as well. So it was just so crushing. And just as a point of order, Villeneuve went even quicker in practice. He did a lap that was 3/4 tenths quicker in free practice when the track was a bit faster as well. Just crushingly dominant.
Oh, it's just, it was incredible. Now, we've talked previously, I think I've talked to Mark Hughes about this in a previous episode, about Jacques was good here. He was good around Melbourne. And obviously had been on pole the year before, but yeah, at this point you're just thinking, right, here we go. Or I mean, everybody else except me is thinking, oh god, another season of crushing dominance. Matt compared it to looking like it was going to be 92. Now obviously, Ben, the knock-on effect here was that Villeneuve being so far ahead made the 107% cutoff a bit more challenging than it should have been for those at the back of the field. And this weekend, those at the back of the field scrambling to get into the race. And we're not talking about the Lolas. You know, we've done a Lola episode in full.
Oh, I wonder where this is going.
They're not getting a look in here. But we are talking about the reigning world champion, Damon Hill.
Do we have to talk about
it? The other memorable part for me of this session is, you know, you had Villeneuve doing incredible things at the front and you had like the battle for the leading places. But Damon kind of had his own spin-off show within qualifying, didn't he? It's Damon Hill against the clock, but the clock is the 107% time in his terrible, barely ready arrows.
That's just made me so angry. It makes me angry trying to think about it now, actually.
What exactly are you angry about? Who are you angry at?
Just
Frank Williams,
world.
Probably.
Frank Williams, yeah. Frank Williams.
He chose that team.
Heinz-Harald Frentzen a bit too. Yeah. You know, maybe probably wouldn't have out-qualified Villeneuve at Melbourne. You know, it was a new track. It was the second season of that track. So, you know, that kind of helped Villeneuve. Everyone's coming in kind of cold from 96 onwards. But Damon would have been easily second and then, you know, probably would have won the race. His brakes somehow won't fail and everything would be great. Just, it was torture for me to watch the guy won the world championship the year before, being a car that rubbish and barely make the grid. Horrendous.
It was a total injustice. You know, when Damon signed for Arrows, you're thinking, oh, this is a gamble. But Arrows hadn't been this bad the year before. So you're thinking maybe, oh, if he can elevate them a bit, you know, he might get into the top 10, or maybe he can fight for points here and there. There was nothing about what we'd seen from Arrows the year before to suggest if you go there, you're going to be scrambling to get, you know, what did he qualify, 20th?
But yeah, but adding in the tyre elements and the terrible engine and everything else, it was all wrong. And it got better later in the season.
It's worth noting that I think their struggles were slightly exaggerated, because Hill was in the spare car, which seemed to be shockingly all over the place, had braking problems, struggled to point it in a straight line. And actually, he'd been moderately brisk in practice. Tom Walkinshaw even pointed out, if you combine his best sectors from practice, he'd have been ninth.
Oh, the best sectors are.
Carting down approach to things. But this reflected how underprepared they were, in that the spare car was just an absolute mess.
And obviously, Ben, it didn't get any better the next day, because, I was going to say, not only is Damon lining up 20th on the grid, but he didn't actually get to, because what did he do? Two corners of the formation lap?
And then it caught fire or whatever, didn't it? Blew up. So
did you go back to bed at that point?
I think in some ways it was just a relief, because then I could just... Because at that point, you can just enjoy the race for what it is. The guy you're rooting for, you know, there's no reason to care anymore, is there? Or be furious about the fact that he's, you know, tugging around at the back in a terrible car. It's put everyone, including him, out of his misery.
It was it's another one of the enduring visual memories from this race. If you didn't go back and rewatch it to refresh your memory, or watch the season review or whatever, you can, if you watched it, you remember exactly where he pulls up. You remember the body language. I felt so sorry for him, Ed, watching him sort of just clamber out of the car. And you're just thinking, what on earth has he got himself into? This is not befitting of the world champion.
The thing that I was really impressed with was, as you say, not befitting the world champion. Not only did he retire on the warm-up lap, he was also helping the marshals push the car away, which I thought was very, very decent of him. But yeah, I think it was just, what have I done? He does a little hand gesture, doesn't he? Sort of, oh, what have I done? Which, yeah. I don't know whether that's about the car or about his life choices in general. But yeah, a low moment.
Yeah, we've discussed on many a previous episode all the different options Damon had. Obviously, Jackie Stewart was pushing hard. They wouldn't have been a huge step up. Jordan were interested, but they say that, well, they've told us that Damon's management weren't interested in the sort of numbers that they were willing to put forward at that point. You do think, though, don't you, that Damon Hill in the 97 Jordan, Ben, that's the missed opportunity here.
Yeah, definitely. That car, even McLaren, you know, he had talks with McLaren, and it was a similar kind of story. Ron didn't want to pay him the worth of a world champion in Damon's management's eyes. But I just wish they'd swallowed the pride, you know.
Get
yourself in something better. Yeah, take the quick car, you know, like to have the number one on that awful machine. It made that year, as incredible as it was, so difficult for me to watch.
Yeah, well, you've taken it well, and you've obviously got a while to wait before we get to Hungary. okay, dramatic start to the season, dramatic start to the Australian Grand Prix. I'll be interested to see how you guys feel about this, because obviously Eddie Irvine steams down the inside on a piece of track I don't think I've seen anyone use before or since on the way down to Tokyo. If you watch the overhead replay of this, there's a brief moment before... I think one of the McLarens, maybe Coulthard, backs out of it. There's a moment where Irvine makes it four wide on the way down to the first corner, locks up, steams into Villeneuve. Poor Johnny Herbert is on the outside. Villeneuve and Herbert end up in the gravel. Irvine limps on a few more corners before retiring. Obviously, I have to admit, the only bit of this that's self-inflicted from Villeneuve, Matt, is that he made a terrible start.
Oh, I don't even think it's that as terrible as I remember it, watching it back on the replay. He's coming out of the first corner, probably third at worst, if no one harpoons him from a mile off. It's a concertina thing, isn't it? Irvine's made a really good start from fifth. Villeneuve's made a pretty bad start from first. And then, like you say, Irvine just tries to do something completely impossible. Actually, it's a much worse move watching it back than I've remembered it for the last 27 or whatever it is years. I almost start to give him benefit of the doubt and think he'd been lambasted unfairly. But no, he's got no hope of making the corner sensibly without wiping people out. It's a proper, everything's concertinaed, I may as well go for it. Or like a panic move. Suddenly the only space in front of him is that ridiculous one that won't make the corner. I said my summary of the race was Johnny Herbert was robbed, and I felt that strongly at the time. My logic being, Herbert was wheel to wheel with Villeneuve. Herbert's start was great, actually.
Mega
qualified
start.
Seventh.
Yeah, fantastic.
Mega start. And he was on course to come out either second alongside Villeneuve or third behind Villeneuve. I'm sure Villeneuve would have passed him easily. But then Herbert had been third in the warm-up, only slower than the Williams. Looking at how Nicola Larini, his Sauber teammate, did in that race, and work on the basis that Herbert was about a second lap quicker than Larini all the time they were teammates, Herbert's got a reasonable chance of being in the podium mix on merit and kind of hanging around where the McLarens and Ferrari, well, the remaining Ferrari was. In my youth, I kind of came up with a scenario in which Johnny Herbert won that race for Sauber, which, having looked at the numbers now, is just bollocks and had no chance of happening. Like on my Frentzen rewriting of that season in which he was good. But I think there was a podium for Herbert, and I was really sad about that at the time. I just thought Villeneuve is going to win loads more races. This might be as good as it gets for Herbert and Sauber. And after his 95 and a 96 not offering much, I was really, really gutted for him. This looked like it was going to be something great.
The thing that I really like about that is the war of words that followed after it. There were some great quotes that the idiot screwed it up again. That I mentioned at the beginning was Johnny Herbert, and Eddie Irvine was still
me as well.
Eddie Irvine was still moaning about it in his Autosport column after. He called the reactions juvenile from Villeneuve and Herbert. Villeneuve was still having a go at him in Brazil a few weeks later, so it was just great. But it was really interesting because I think actually you mentioned DC backed out of it, and he did a little bit, but I also think DC, because he knew where he was on the track,
he just braked in the right place.
Well, part of it was a function of that. And Irvine claims, oh, well, I locked up, yeah, but I got it back and I was fine. And then Villeneuve hit me and I got a puncture. And it's like, yeah, but even after he comes out of the lockup, you can see the rears squirming. It was an Irvine mess up. But I like the way he absolutely committed to, no, I'm not having it, I'm fine. The stewards who did look at it cleared me, and yeah, it's just everyone complaining at me. I quite liked his belligerence about it, because I'm sure deep down he knew he messed it up badly.
Yeah, it was very on brand for Eddie Irvine to not concede any ground. That stewards point is a good one, though. Does anyone think that in modern F1 stewarding, is Irvine picking up a penalty there?
Yeah, I reckon so. Yeah.
Must be, yeah.
The locked brakes and everything else, it's like you're out of control, aren't you? Even if you get it back a bit, you know, it reminds me of Valtteri Bottas' Hungary pinball.
Skittling everybody.
Even with like first lap allowance, that's just like, no, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I think, Matt, you obviously said that you had to watch it back to remind yourself of how bad it is. I can assure you, it's another thing that I never needed to watch back. When I do watch it back, it looks exactly as I remember it at the time. And I was going to say it took me a long time to forgive Irvine for this. I'm not sure I ever did. Anyway, I'm over it now. I promise. Let's move into the race then. So Frentzen takes the lead, has taken the lead ahead of all this. And I'll admit at that point, I thought, well, he's probably going to walk it now because the Williams is clearly a much better car than everybody else's. But we had Frentzen.
But he's tight handle Frentzen.
Yeah, there is that. He was two stopping for reasons we'll get into a bit later on. Everyone else is pretty much one stopping. So in the middle of the race, when the one stoppers are coming in, we end up, Jean Alesi gets up to second behind Coulthard, who's yet to stop. I'd say it's a net fifth, really, for Alesi, because the running order at this point should have been DC, Schumacher, Frentzen, Hakkinen. They should have all been in front of him, I'd say, around pit stops. But Alesi's running second, and then it's his turn to come in, and he doesn't. Now, if producer Johnny can find the commentary, I'm sure we'll play Murray Walker's iconic "Oh, Jean" line at this point.
Alesi knows. And there we are! Now, if Alesi has run out of petrol, I could use an Anglo-Saxon expression to say what his boss, Flavio Briatore, who is an Italian, will be saying to him. And you can see by the body language of the Benetton mechanics that they are absolutely furious. gas, because they know that Alesi has been told to come in lap after lap after lap, and what does he do? He ignores them. And there's... Oh, Jean, you may well look a bit worried. You've got a major problem, Sunshine, when you get back to the pits. And
now, Ed, is this one of Jean Alesi's most memorable moments in F1?
Oh, massively so. Yeah, it's completely mad. I mean, ultimately, he did have a radio problem, but they were waving the pit board at him for some time. They were hanging Nick Worth, who was the chief designer, over the pit wall by his belt to try and get him to...
And he's pretty tall as well.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And apparently as many as 5 laps they were showing it for. So, yeah, it was
make contact with the helmet, yeah, as he drives.
Exactly, it's extraordinary. Alan Permane's race engineer admitted maybe they should have checked the pit board visibility in practice. But it was really weird. And there's always been this rumour that it was also Alesi trying to make a point. And it may not have been quite such an accident, because there was a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes trying to cut his and Gerhard Berger's pay. And there were lots of fallings out with Flavio Briatore going on there. I've never really got to the bottom of whether there's any truth in that. But everyone at Benetton does say the radio doesn't work. So it seems more likely it was some genuine comedy. But yeah, it's a classic Alesi moment.
Yeah, he had a tendency to go to sleep a bit, didn't he, as well? So you can well imagine that there's an element of him just doing his own thing.
Minding his own business.
Yeah, and I know better than anyone how much fuel's left in the car. So
I'm having a lovely time. Yeah, the car's getting quicker and quicker. So why could this be happening?
I want a brilliant... This is better than my qualifier. Oh no, it's all over. But I take Ed's point about the politics as well, because Berger... I mean, he would, I suppose, because he was the other potential victim in this. It backs up this idea that all was not well behind the scenes at Benetton. But it's a kind of, it's a weird thing to do, to park in that way, you know, just to make a point. There would have been a lot less hassly ways to do that. And he could have done it much earlier in the race too.
Yeah, it would be bold if it was intentional. So we move on then. So as I said, Frentzen was two stopping. So when he comes in for that second stop, it's a slow stop. And
classic Williams.
Yeah. Because of refueling, hard to know exactly how much time was lost. But I think the stop ends up being, what, 15 or 16 seconds. So you could say maybe a 7 or 8 second time loss. And after his outlap, he's 7 seconds off the lead, which is Coulthard. So there's every chance Frentzen might have come out from that second stop in the lead, or at least kind of neck and neck with DC. He hunts him down. So with a handful of laps to go, he's 2.8 seconds behind the McLaren, then suffers a memorable, of all the ways to DNF. If Jean Alesi found a memorable way to retire from this race, Heinz-Harald Frentzen certainly did as well. Left front brake explodes approaching turn one, pitches the car into a spin, which obviously Frentzen can do nothing about. Matt, where does this rank in all of your memories of Frentzen, or mis-memories of Frentzen performances and injustices from 97?
Oh, quite high up in injustices. And I haven't watched this back with the ITV commentary, so I might now be doing Murray Walker and Martin Brundle a disservice. But my memory of it is that as he crashed, they went into this big kind of, well, he's so prone to mistakes, look what Williams assigned kind of moan, which to my ears just came across as, he's not Damon Hill, we're going to bitch about him. And then had to kind of retract that when the replay showed quite clearly that his brake had exploded. And in retrospect, I look at the numbers, I think it was, what, 22 seconds ahead of Coulthard before he pitted. That should have been just about right to come out. He is making heavy weather of winning this race in a two-stopping Williams, though. I can't see that he would have hacked past everybody on the road, even though he was catching them pretty quickly. So although I do see this as a lost Frentzen victory that maybe might have changed the confidence and faith in him at Williams and changed the narrative and of his season quite a lot, he could have very easily come out as he gets defeated when he really didn't need to get defeated, pit stop notwithstanding, because he hadn't really shown enough pace to pull far enough ahead anyway.
There's an interesting question in this race of how much you make allowance for the brake problems, because Frentzen was trying to manage it all the way through. They couldn't fit thicker brake discs on the cars. They could only fit 28 millimeters. A few others, like Ferrari, for example, could go up to 30 millimeters. McLaren, I think, were 28 millimeters, but had a more durable brake disc anyway, different manufacturer. But they were aware that was a problem. Big step forward in pace due to the improvement in the tires. So they knew they were in trouble on that brake wear. Frentz said, interesting, was also riding the brake pedal a little bit. That was something their ops engineer, James Robinson, admitted a few weeks later when they were doing some testing to solve this. So it's hard to balance up how much of it was how much Frentzen was kind of restricted by that management throughout the race. They knew they had problems.
Part of the reason they two-stopped, wasn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Well, the only reason they two-stopped, ultimately. They may have been better off running the hard Goodyears rather than the softs, because pretty much everyone went with the soft tyre option apart from, I think, the Ferraris. So maybe they could have won if they'd done that. But I think Frentzen, you have to give him the benefit of the doubt on this one, because he had enough to have come out ahead of DC if they'd not botched the pit stop, and then maybe it would have been easier to manage rather than trying to catch up the couple at the front that he starts setting after losing ground. So yeah, there's different ways you can slice and dice the criticism of Frentzen on that, but I think on balance you have to say the fault was more with Williams, with the misjudgment they made with the brakes.
Yeah. Now obviously by the end, when Frentzen falls off, he's only chasing DC. The reason for that is that the man who'd been chasing DC for the entire race before that point was Michael Schumacher, but he had to come back in for a late splash and dash pit stop, I think it was. So that at least freed up Frentzen's path to Coulthard prior to the failure. So once Frentzen's retired, Coulthard is then cruising to his first win for McLaren. McLaren's first win since Ayrton Senna at the end of 1993. This is a win on debut for the new Mercedes-inspired Silver Arrows livery, which I felt was significant at the time. So obviously McLaren have gone through longer win droughts than this since, Ben. But at the time, it, to me at least, it felt significant. Is McLaren are a winning F1 team again?
Yeah, this is cool. I wasn't too sure about the livery at the time. Like, it did grow on me a bit, but you know, after iconic like white and red Marlborough liveries, I couldn't really get
I thought on. They did well. It's very hard to replace an iconic livery, but I thought at least they committed.
Yeah, they did. I couldn't really get on board with it, but
it wasn't like when they lost Vodafone.
God, no, the 2014 livery, awful. I mean, they were awful looking cars anyway, but the McLaren was particularly bad. This is kind of the feel-good ending for me, because, I mean, obviously, you know, my interest in this race ended before it started. So for Coulthard to win for McLaren, I thought that was had a bit of a soft spot for DC. I was thinking, well, if Damon can't do it, then it's good that he's up there. And
outrageous British bias, boo.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Outrageous British bias. But I'm allowed. Fan me is allowed. So, you know, deal with that. As a family, we lived in Woking, so McLaren was kind of the local team for us. And my dad,
Woking bias.
Woking bias. My dad contracted for McLaren as well. So
a few employment times bias.
Been able to visit the factory and sit in the old cars and stuff. So I was a bit of a McLaren fan.
Yeah, no way.
and it was cool to see them kind of come good again. And I wish it could have lasted really and been a bit more that year, because it would have helped my interest overall with Damon, you know, wasting the twilight of his career in a terrible car and his world champion status. McLaren was something for my interest to cling to.
It did in that moment on that Melbourne Sunday feel real as well. Like, this is such a tangible step forward from where McLaren was in 96. Even though it had its moments, they would tend to be like, DC would do a great start and then cling on for a while, or Hakkinen was really quick at Suzuka, I think. But it wasn't really... this wasn't really McLaren back, whereas this, they were close enough to Frentzen around his problems. And at the time, actually, I wasn't really thinking about the brake conservation. I was just thinking, look, McLaren's got good race pace ahead of Schumacher, who had started to look stronger and stronger through 96. I was like, this is actually McLaren doing something real. And I loved that it was cool.
It's like they are now, isn't it? They are now. If you know, like, if Verstappen's brakes have failed and he's off the road and a few other cars have dropped out, it's, oh, yeah, actually, yeah, Norris or Piastri could sniff a victory. And Coulthard and Hakkinen are in that kind of situation here at this point.
Yeah, but I don't see McLaren dominating 2025 with a car. Well, not. I know McLaren didn't dominate 98 in the end, but it had a very good attempt at doing it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it felt like this is a good storyline. This is McLaren properly back. I actually quite like the livery. As much as anything else, I like the fact it was a fresh livery over the winter. It was great to see a car reveal and go, oh, that's different.
But also, and they've run in orange in the winter as well, haven't they? That was the first clever winter move. Where the orange came back.
Yeah, clever move to sort of bridge the gap a bit as well, just get the Marlborough out of your head slightly almost. But I loved that it was DC, not Hakkinen. I'd really liked what Coulthard was doing at Williams. He was half a second quicker than Hakkinen qualifying in Melbourne, and they gave each other a massive cuddle at the end of the race in a really kind of real way as well, like that.
Yeah, that was really classy.
Yeah, mutual relief that McLaren was on the way back. I was like, oh, this could be good, and it could be Coulthard leading it, not Hakkinen. Absolutely wasn't, as it turned out, when McLaren got really, really good. But DC will always have Melbourne 97.
Really well taken win by DC as well, because Schumacher was there until he had to make the extra stop, was there all the time. There wasn't much.
Constant pressure.
So there was little margin for error for DC. So really well taken.
Yeah, and with the Hakkinen thing, I'm sure it will come up at points during this series. We didn't know then, but we do know now, Mika at this point in the year still wasn't fully recovered from his Adelaide 95 shunt. So yeah, that I felt the same. I thought, here we go. Like, McLaren are good again, and David Coulthard's going to be their lead driver. Like, his move is perhaps going to pay off. But we'll leave it there. We've kicked off the 1997 F1 season again in style. Congratulations to David Coulthard and McLaren. So DC's leading the championship. We'll give you little updates on that as we go. Thanks, of course, to Ed, Matt and Ben for helping us get this new format off the ground. And to the Race Members Club, thank you for listening. Thank you for signing up. We will see you again very soon for the Brazilian Grand Prix.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.